Doctors have a bit of a special place in my heart, not just because I was raised by one, but because I think in being raised by one and then working in industry and then becoming a psychotherapist as part of my second career, being able to connect back with some of the smartest, most incredible physician leaders I've ever worked with has afforded me the perspective of both how difficult the job is, especially post-pandemic, but also how incredibly gratifying it is and what an incredible difference it makes when you are with a physician who can attune to you as a patient emotionally, that actually improves healthcare outcomes, and there's data to support that. So with no further ado, here is the next episode in this series with some of the physician leaders I'm excited to introduce to you, and circling around the topics of burnout in healthcare, psychological safety, leadership, transformational leadership in medicine, and incredible advocacy all around. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Christina Crow Podcast, Making the Invisible Visible. I'm your host, Christina Crow. I'm a psychotherapist and a relentless mental health advocate in Ontario, Canada. I'm bringing you my clinical insights and research-based facts on modern mental health, and I'm going to bring you the experts I rely on to share their wisdom with you. Let's do it, guys. Let's dig a little deeper and make invisible things visible. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Christina Crow Podcast, where we connect the dots in search for more balanced mental health. I'm your host, psychotherapist Christina Crow, and I love making invisible things visible. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with two incredibly impressive leaders in medicine, Dr. Christine Bresden-Masley and Dr. Christine Simmons. Dr. Simmons is a medical oncologist at the BCCA Vancouver and clinical associate professor at the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. She completed her residency training in Toronto and completed a fellowship at Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto. She also completed a master's in clinical epidemiology at U of T. Her academic interests span both teaching and research, and she has held several leadership roles in the undergraduate medical program at UBC in the areas of clinical skills and oncology education. Her research interests are in the areas of health services reach in breast cancer and sarcoma. She recently founded the Sarcoma Outcomes Unit at the BCCA and is the founder and chair of the not-for-profit organizations Women in Cancer and All in Cancer. Dr. Christine Bresden-Masley is a practicing medical oncologist and the medical director of the cancer program at Sinai Health System in Toronto. She's also the director of the Marvel Koffler Breast Center at Sinai Health and holds the Marvel Koffler Chair in Breast Research. She obtained her PhD in medical biophysics at the Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto and her medical degree from the University of Toronto. She's currently an associate professor at the Temerty Faculty of Medicine, University of Toronto, and an associate scientist at the Lennenfeld-Tannenbaum Research Institute in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Bresden treats both breast and gastrointestinal, colorectal, and gastric cancers malignancies, which are her major areas of research interest. Her main area of clinical research is cardiotoxicity from cancer therapy and is the past president of the Canadian Cardio-Oncology Network. She co-chairs the Junior Mentoring Program JUMP, that fosters mentorship and sponsorship of junior medical oncology faculty across Canada, and serves on the executive of WINC, Women in Cancer, All in Cancer. She is an advocate for patients and serves as a board member of Rethink Breast Cancer and My Gut Feeling, and also serves on the scientific committee for the Colorectal Cancer Resource and Action Network. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming to this show. I'm so honored to have you and to know you. And I just want to say for everyone listening, because we're all named Christine and Christina, we might revert to referring to each other by our last names, just so nobody gets confused.
It's also kind of natural as well, right? For us, yeah. To when we're talking to each other. It's weird to call someone else by your own name, for sure. Thank you for that introduction, Crow. And it, as you were reading it, it kind of made me think about how bad we are about talking about ourselves. I think that's kind of a human nature thing that everyone resonates with on some level, right? Most of us don't really feel comfortable talking about ourselves. And as you were reading the intro, for a moment, I was like, oh, I did that? Oh, I guess I did. And then I realized that actually I was bad at sending you an updated bio and realized that mine was a little bit out of date. But
out of date, Simmons, and lacking. You have talk about jump. Simmons.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's the walking of the talk when we mentor others and we're talking to residents. I'm the program director now for the residency training program, but I'm always telling them to add stuff to their CV. And as you were reading that, Crow, I was like, oh, Simmons, you failed.
Well, you guys were trying to get me to say less too. So I was like, no, yes. I have to at least read what I have here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having both Simmons and me on today, because we really appreciate the time and the acknowledgement.
So thank you for that. I am endlessly impressed. First of all, honored to know you guys as long as I have, and endlessly impressed with what you continue to do as leaders, as educators, as clinicians, to lead your institutions and I think create spaces where people can develop and do a really hard job. And so I've been involved with some of the work you guys have been doing lately with the JUMP program. And Dr. Bresden, can you tell our audience a little bit more about what that program is and how it all started?
Sure, happy to. So JUMP stands for Junioring Mentoring Program, so J-U-M-P. And it was actually started by Dr. Susan Dent, one of our colleagues who has left University of Ottawa and has gone to Duke in North Carolina. And she started in 2010, recognizing that there was a huge gap in junior faculty. So medical oncologists that have just started out in their first 5 years, and provide an area, an opportunity to mentor them and really pair about, she typically would have 5 mentees and pair them with 5 mentors and spend a day of a workshop and really making connections, providing support, mentoring, working on their CVs, which is a curriculum vitae, which is important as an academic oncologist, but also important as an oncologist in working. So that started in 2010. And then when she left Canada to go to the United States to practice, that was in 2019, right before the pandemic, this was going to close. And so she and I were in contact. We were both cardio-oncologists. Mm-hmm. And I asked whether or not we can maintain JUMP and if I could take it over. So she said, absolutely. And I needed a partner. And my dear friend, Dr. Christine Simmons, was kind enough to partner with me and co-chair the JUMP. And so we've been now doing it since 2019. We had a small hiatus, obviously, during COVID. And so we've been strong, moving forward, changed it quite a bit. Obviously, Christina Crow, bringing you on, which is fantastic, spending an afternoon with us, talking about psychological safety, talking about mentorship, specifically in oncology and in medicine. And this has really taken off. And this year, we will be hosting it in Vancouver. So another big piece is that we like to have it across Canada. So we pick cities across Canada. We have 6 mentors, so senior faculty, and we will have 6 mentees. I'm pleased to say that there are 13 junior faculty who have applied this year.
Wow.
And it's a peer-reviewed process where we pick 6 mentees for this year, and hopefully we can do it again next year.
What you had said earlier, Crow, about doing a hard job well, right? Mm-hmm. As you were saying that, I was thinking it sounds funny. It sounds like an oxymoron. It's not difficult to do a hard job well, so long as you are feeling safe, so long as you are being encouraged to grow, so long as you are feeling valued for the work that you're doing. And I think that the JUMP program is a really important program because it does provide those who are about to enter this very difficult career, to be perfectly honest with you, the tools to continue to grow, to continue to ensure that they are achieving their highest potential, and those connections that allow them to have that safe outlet to connect with someone, to connect with oncologists across the country.
Yeah.
Was when I was in fellowship, I realized, because I think for all of us in medicine in general, but I think in oncology as well, there's a little bit of the homework, that I need to do my homework, I need to look up all the math. Mm-hmm. So I looked up to see how many oncologists are there in this whole country. I'm a bit of a friendly person. And so I realized that when you actually look at the Canadian Medical Association, which mm-hmm. albeit maybe not all medical oncologists are registered in, mm-hmm. it's a pretty decent litmus test. When you look at it year on year, going back for about the past decade, there are about 500 to 600 medical oncologists in Canada. That number has actually not changed much in the past decade.
Yeah.
Whereas our population has increased, the complexity of cancer care has increased. And when you look at that number, like 500 to 600, that's a big wedding.
That feels really low.
It is. It is. Yeah. Every medical oncologist in Canada, there are four cardiologists.
Right? Wow. So
when you think
about
You guys are like having like psychiatry numbers here.
We are truly, we are truly, as Simon said, we are truly understaffed.
Wow.
And for those listening on the podcast, medical oncologists, being a cancer doctor, the good news is that patients are living longer.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is that one in two of us will have a cancer diagnosis in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reality. And so when you think of 50% of us will have a cancer diagnosis in Canada, we don't have enough oncologists to serve that population, and that will continue to grow. In addition to that, as I mentioned, that we're getting better therapies, but when we look at who our patients are in our clinic, 70% of the patients that we treat have advanced disease.
Mm-hmm.
So metastatic disease. Now, they're surviving.
Yeah.
Many of them are doing well, but they're coming into our clinic all the time for treatment. So as I said, we are providing life-saving therapy. We're making really important decisions with our patients. We are always on. We never can really shut ourselves off. It's like a dialysis patient, right? They need dialysis to live.
Mm-hmm.
Many of our patients need their therapies to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so we continue to be providing that support to our patients. So we never shut off. We never turn off. We go on holidays. And unfortunately, many of us still have we're connected by all of our technologies today.
Yep.
And that is where we're looking at burnout. And we're looking at burnout in our medical colleges.
Mm-hmm.
We are probably one of the highest at risk of burnout. And that's why for us, for Simmons and I, it was really important to address this with our junior faculty. To address this, as you said, I'm the director of the cancer program at Sinai. Simmons is the program director. And so she and I both have opportunities to make some difference with respect to providing that nurturing, ensuring that the people we work with all feel valued for what they do. So there is less burnout that occurs with the people that we work with. But I do want to put a plug in for what Simmons has also created, and you touched on it in her bio, Women in Cancer.
Yep.
So Simmons remarkably, because she's so brilliant and, of course, my dear friend, noticed that women are mentored differently than men. This was noted in 2008, 2009. She and I had the opportunity to work together, which was a huge pleasure when she was still in Toronto. And she organized WINC, which is Women in Cancer. And then it morphed because, of course, we don't want to be just a woman inclusive. It became All in Cancer.
Yeah.
So really supporting all, but that is a mentorship.
Yeah. And I mean, it was never exclusive of men, like aside from the title, we were very careful and very mindful that anyone could join, just as the word feminism doesn't apply just to women, right?
Yep.
But so we did have men that were joining and champions. And in fact, some of our greatest champions were our male colleagues. But as you said, Bresden, it was that realization that women mentor women differently than men mentor women. Mm-hmm. You need both. You need a portfolio. And I think that was also a shift in thinking from when Bresden and I trained, where there's like, oh, I have a mentor. No. You need to diversify. Yep. You need a whole host of mentors in your career, no matter what kind of individual you are, quite frankly, but especially in medicine. And so the purpose of the organization was to really provide that ability to connect. If there's only 500 of us in the whole country, how come we're not all friends? Let's develop a forum and a platform where we can connect virtually. This was on the heels of Facebook prior to Zoom, right? So I like to think we were a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of developing forums and virtual groups. And it was really well received. We had a lot of uptake, a lot of value that was seen. And we highlighted and valued and promoted those who were within the organization, right? We had even those that weren't within the organization. Hey, are you looking for a mentor in Saskatchewan? Here's so-and-so, mentor of the month. This is why she's great, and this is why she's nominated. And both the mentors and the mentees who were identified in these fun little things that we did every month really valued that. So that was the broader sense of connecting everyone. And is it not exclusive of men? And we did change or develop a brother group, if you will, All in Cancer, which is kind of the same thing, but basically the title is different. So it's not as intimidating, I guess, for people who don't identify as women to join. But also that the title and the organization is also not exclusive of other professions, right? Other types of researchers. Hey, our emergency colleagues are treating cancer. In my head, quite frankly, just to let you all in my head for a moment, given that 50% of Canadians are going to be diagnosed with cancer, geez, it doesn't matter what kind of physician, you are going to be someone who is treating cancer.
There's going to be a lot of touch points there.
We're all in it together. Let's share. You know,
you guys have created quite a context, I think, for people listening to understand a little bit more about, I think, the incredible responsibility of your role. And the pressure that comes with it that you take willingly because you have the capacity to. I think there's a lot of places where some brains listening might be like, this sounds terrifying. I want no part of this. And there's other brains that are like, this is exciting. I want to be a part of this, right? And it is just this place with how do you manage the pressures of this job for the people you lead, but also continue to get the best of a bunch of really smart people. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And what a balancing act that must be. Mentorship, just in general, is so protective for people who are striving to be their best. It's really important. And it lines up really nicely with a therapeutic modality I practice, interpersonal psychotherapy, which is really kind of the basic premise is the quality of our life is kind of equal to the quality of our relationships. And when we're struggling, when we're depressed, when we feel left behind or traumatized, if we can lean into the strength and the protectiveness of the relationships that we have interpersonally at work in our communities, then that's where we find comfort and a space to heal and the ability to thrive, right? Hey, mental health therapists, clinicians, and ADHD coaches. Are you ready to take your knowledge about ADHD to the next level? Introducing the Dig Deeper School, where you can fine-tune your skills to provide the best care for your patients. But wait, it's not just for professionals. If you're someone eager to understand ADHD better, our courses are designed for you too. Learn, grow, and know that you're receiving top-notch care. Explore the show notes for the links and embark on your journey to boost your ADHD literacy and competencies. It's time to make a difference. Join us at the Dig Deeper School. Enter the code PODSQUADVIP at checkout for 15% off any of our courses.
Totally. And as you were talking about this, Crow, it kind of reminded me of the polarity paradox versus problem. approach, right? And I think that as people who've, as physicians, as nurses, as anyone in healthcare, there is a problem, right? There is a sick person. Yep. There is a solution, or there's mm-hmm. not. But we approach everything very much problem focused. Okay, what is the problem? What is the potential solutions? How are we going to get there? And here is the outcome. Mm-hmm. When it comes to work-life balance, when it comes to that balance, we're trying to approach this as a problem again, but it is not a problem. It is a paradox, mm-hmm. right? Clarity there. A problem is a problem for which there is a solution, but this polarity paradox, this is a dilemma for which there is interdependent opposites, yeah. right?
There's and no clear-cut answer.
Exactly, yeah. And it's important for us to not be upset with that. And I think that's where people often get a lot of stress mm-hmm. is in thinking, oh my God, how do I balance everything? How do I be a super mom, but also right. be a super doc? How do I do all of this? And there's this thing called the polarity map that I was looking at recently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's four quadrants, right? Mm-hmm. If I was to describe it. And at your highest potential, you have purpose. You are feeling great about what you're doing. You're awesome. You're achieving. And at the bottom is kind of that fear, that anxiety and distress. Mm-hmm. And on the one side, that's the north-south. And if they were mm-hmm. going west, you have like work on one side and home or personal life on the other side.
Okay.
And the key is trying to realize that when things are going really well at work, that probably there's some sacrifices that are happening at home.
Of course.
Yeah. But trying to make sure that you're not going too deep into that negative side of the curve so that anxiety and that fear doesn't come into play. And likewise, when things are really great at home, there's probably some sacrifices you're making at work. And likewise, mm-hmm. making sure that you're staying in tune with your own personal satisfaction on a mm-hmm. feeling highly purposeful and highly fulfilled versus feeling highly anxious and highly fearful.
It matters what you tell yourself about why all these things are happening.
Yeah, and I think, and as Simmons mentioned, I mean, that's where going back to the JUMP program is that you really want to start developing those skills. And I call it work-life integration because that's what it is, not a balance. I guess the way you're describing it, a little bit of a teeter-totter balance, but it is an integration of the two. Mm-hmm. And if we can really provide our own experiences, what worked, what didn't work, mm-hmm. and really support them as they try to have that integration between really demanding work. So when you're starting out, I can say specifically if you're starting out as an academic oncologist, mm-hmm. there is the physician part that you have to take care of many patients, mm-hmm. but also the academic part where you have to be productive with research or education or whatever other part of the university focus that you've been signed on to. Mm-hmm. So that's where a lot of stressors come in. And When we look at burnout, kind of that paradox that Simmons was alluding to, is that we have to ensure our colleagues at us that we learn to also spend time with our colleagues outside of work a little bit. So if I can just put forward, we call it something called oncotourism. So one thing that we have really created, and I think, you know, we do go to meetings and we have to have a little bit of fun too. We have to spend time with each other. Yeah. Simmons and I think I would say she's my sister from another mother. We spend a lot of time together. Our family spend time together, but it's also with our colleagues, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll go to meetings and we're able to then vent because we're all oncologists.
Yeah.
So that provides us a safe, you know, a safe opportunity or a safe space to actually talk about all of the challenges we have with either our institution, with our patients, with everything, like mm-hmm. with ourselves, with our academia, personally, but it also gives that opportunity to vent. And we all need that opportunity to vent.
Yeah.
Right. And then also hopefully provide solutions just by having someone listen and understand and validate what you're going through is a huge part of support.
Yeah, and I mean, even in there's always that video as well that comes to my mind. It's not about the nail. Sometimes
love that video.
I know, right? I mean, so sometimes funny. You need to vent, and there is no solution, but you feel so much better from being heard from people who understand these intangibles of relationship with others within your profession is so important. And I think that in a society where everything is very much about the product and about how many patients have been seen, how much for our colleagues in industry, how much of their drug is being used, for our colleagues in cardiology, how many echoes are being done. I don't know, all sorts of things. I'm making up stuff I don't
know. And timeline. Have you seen your patient in 2 weeks?
Timelines that, you know, all of these metrics,
pressures,
all of these things about what you're doing, right? But we're not human doings.
Yes.
We're human beings, right? Yes. And we have to really think about who do we have to be in order to do our job?
Yeah.
Who do we have to be in order to lead our organization?
Can I ask you guys a question? So I know I've worked for people who have thought it was really terrible to get people to talk about what's hard because that would somehow start like this negative pity party and woe is me. And so their fear was having there be things that could never be spoken about. And it sounds like I think I could probably say just generally because women are relational. Tell me if I'm wrong. That might be something that women will find their way out of naturally, unless it's trained out of you, right? Like developmentally in your 20s, becoming a physician, and then learning that, oh, we don't talk about those things and we just keep calm and soldier on. Like, what was it like for you guys coming up in medicine, figuring out what you could and couldn't talk about?
There was, I do think that when we were training in Breslin, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a lot of the keep calm, carry on, stiff upper lip, not expected that you would, definitely not expected you would show emotion with a patient. Like, God, you got to keep it together. I think Breslin was the first one who we were caring for a patient, or I think somehow we were caring for a patient together, or it was a patient that was Breslin's that was transitioning to my practice. Mm-hmm. And we were there in the room. And I remember actually this gentleman very well. He was a lovely gentleman and he had advanced colorectal cancer and he was struggling. And I had just started at St. Mike's and Breslin had been caring for this man for a while and he had transitioned into my practice. But we were at quite a critical point in his care. And given that Breslin had that long-term relationship with him, he was admitted and wanted to come in and see how he was doing as we were talking about next steps in care. And it was an emotional encounter and it was sad. And this is a person who had been very strong, very robust, and clearly Breslin, they had developed quite a long time that she had been caring for him. And as we were talking, I looked over and Breslin's there and she had tears in her eyes.
Yeah.
And having that moment, then of course I got tears in my eyes and he had tears in his eyes. And at some point in that conversation, I just remember it's shifting to a point that actually he started comforting us. And I'm getting tears in my eyes just thinking about it. Mm. But I remember him looking at us and it was very sweet at the time. And he said, you both have the same eyes, right? And I was like, he's identifying that we're both feeling the same thing.
Yeah, the love. I think he felt loved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. As we love our patients, right?
Yeah. And he said to us, he said, how wonderful is it for you to be able to work with your sister?
Wow.
I know. Right. And then Breslin's like, she's not my sister, but because we're not actually.
You are. I know. Right?
But, you know, it was that intent, right? That love that was in the room that he felt from us. Mm-hmm. And that he recognized that we had for each other as well.
Yeah.
It's okay.
That's attunement.
To be loved for your patients, right?
Yeah,
and that was
absolutely.
Kind of a really big tipping point for me, I think, in my career that it's okay to love your patients. Right?
Yeah.
It's probably important for you to love your patients if you love what you do.
Yeah. Geez.
Yeah.
How could you do this work if you didn't, right?
Yeah.
Like long-term, I think it would be really hard to not be integrated, like to be compartmentalized off, which in some ways is kind of like also the hard part of the things that are hard, I think, about balancing these skills as an oncologist, because you don't get to debrief. You have to go from patient to patient, regardless of how well or not well people are doing. And you don't necessarily get the time to stop and feel your feelings. And feeling your feelings is what allows you to not be traumatized by them. But like, when you're supposed to book that into your day in your bathroom break, like
one thing that we have developed, and I think it's pretty much, well, I can't say for all centers, but we all work in a multidisciplinary team, right? So we're not working alone. We've got nurses that are with us. We have trainees, fellows, residents, which is great if you're in an academic institution. But that being said, we do debrief because we say bye to many patients.
Yeah.
And saying bye to your patient is one of the most difficult encounters you will have as an oncologist. And when I say bye, it's because there are no full palliation, there's no more treatment.
Right.
And so we had to say bye to a couple of patients last week. And I remember after I made sure that I work with a nurse practitioner and I made sure that he said bye to this individual. And she passed shortly afterwards. And we all kind of sit and debrief and talk about it. And we work closely with palliative care. End of life is always so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's so difficult for anyone. But as you said, we develop relationships with all of our patients.
Right.
We care for them. Right. We make treatment decisions together. We make life-altering decisions together with them, their caregivers, their families. So it's not only us as an oncologist, but it's the whole team. And so when we do lose a patient, of course, the oncologist, we feel it, but the whole team feels it too. Yeah. Especially those nurses that are seeing those patients all the time and giving them their chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And so we have to recognize that we all work as a team. And I always tell my patients, we celebrate the wins.
Mm-hmm.
We always celebrate the wins. And we're sad when we don't have a win. We're very sad. And it's important to be able to recognize, acknowledge those feelings. There's nothing wrong with those feelings.
Yeah, it's just part of being human.
Yeah. Yeah, it is human. And I think that's what we have to encourage, especially in training, right? And again, when I go back to junior mentoring, right? We have to embrace that. That's who we are. And I think that makes you, that's the empathy that we always talk about, makes you, to me, a better oncologist, because then you can recognize what needs to be done.
Yeah,
you can recognize what people are feeling. You can recognize when you need to get palliative care, when you need to get psychiatry in, when you need to get social work in. You recognize the needs of your patient.
Yeah. I would just want to say, like, I also, from that sadness, it's like, where do you go from there? Walking those journeys with people and these very intricate decision points along the way. There's so many different variables that go into the treatment decisions that get made from someone's very specific pathology that's unique to that person or how that cancer is behaving, to the treatments that are available or the clinical trials that are available or the drug funding that's available. So many things along the way that one of the things, as I said in the beginning, that's also quite exciting is when there's so much research and so much data. I always loved going to like ASCO, and there's nothing like the electricity in that room when they're presenting research that is life-saving or treatment path-altering research, because you're carrying all the patients with you in your heart and in your soul. And when you're integrated in that moment, I just think the ability to understand exactly where this treatment fits and what's going to happen and the hope for the future has also got to be something that fuels and propels this very unique specialty forward, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, absolutely.
You know, and there is a little bit of that polarity too, right? So you're in the room and like there was a major announcement at ASCO 2022 that was, it's a breakthrough and in the room and it's, we're crying, right? We're crying in the room. And then as I'm leaving the room, I'm thinking, I have all of those patients with me. And as I'm leaving the room, there's then that polarity of Monday morning, I'm going to be seeing Mrs. So-and-so and she would benefit from this treatment. I know that now. The data is right up there on that wall behind me, but it's not funded yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that dilemma that we are often in when the information comes out, but now the actual action of getting that drug to our patients. That is a huge, huge issue that is very stressful in our lives. And we actually did some research on this back quite a while ago now, when it comes to actually looking as an oncologist, how much time do we spend trying to get medicine for our patients?
Trying to get medication to our patients.
We're actually doing the nitty gritty, like
paperwork, access request forms,
writing letters, reaching out to pharmaceutical companies, requesting compassionate access at our organizations. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's at least 20% of our week that we spend doing that kind of work.
Personally, right? Like not like an assistant or a secretary, like you've got to do it yourself because you're building
a case
for a patient.
You have to sign off.
And regardless of whether there's a drug access navigator at your organization. It's about.
But that hits again, the burnout rate, right? It's all the administrative tasks that we also have to do that I don't think patients, for example, recognize. We're there to see the patient. We have that one-to-one interaction with our patient. But also it's all the background noise that we have to coordinate their next scan, coordinate a referral somewhere, coordinate a follow-up, coordinate their medication. It's a lot of work. And then, of course, dictate and make sure that we have a medical record of
this
everything that has been discussed. So it is a lot of work on the background.
It is a lot of work, right? But then just to me, because I am a little bit of Susie Sunshine and I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, right? And as you were talking about earlier, Breston, we're not in a vacuum. And I think that when our oncology colleagues, when our clinical colleagues, when our professional colleagues in any profession really suffer from burnout, I think it's when you are isolating yourself kind of and not realizing that you're isolating yourself. Even if you're practicing at a community oncology organization and there isn't a nurse practitioner or GPO or trainees that are on that team with you, there's the clerks.
Yeah.
Like even I'm thinking about
lean on your team, you're saying.
You know, where we've had
lean on your team is right.
Cases. I mean, my gosh, the person who cleans the clinic after we've all left, my friend Minda, we often have little chit chats in the evening, and everyone is involved in the care of these patients. And even the cleaner is saying to me, I saw that you had your patient who you've been seeing each night. I can see that they're not doing well because she has eyeballs in her head when the patient comes in. She's saying like, that must be hard for you. Allowing the team to be your team, allowing that support in.
Do you think it takes a long time for like the junior oncologists or even mid to senior to actually, like, are there a lot of perfectionists? Like, do they think they're supposed to do everything themselves or they're not allowed to, or that's some sort of weakness?
I think
we were all like that. Simmons was like that. I was like that when we first started.
I think it's the myth that we need to really debunk.
That's where jump comes in. That's where jump comes in, right? That's where opportunities of proper, you're not supposed to do it alone and don't expect to. Like change the narrative on that, because it really, you can't do this alone. You can't do this job alone.
What kind of impact do you, if you look back on things that have shifted since you've been running this program, either with the specific people in it or people who hear about it or people who feel the effect of it from the colleagues that are around the actual participants, what are some of the things that you are proud of or that you can say, that's because we've changed the way we do things.
I have to also say that I was a jumper, or I was
a jumpy. She was a jumpy first, and then a jumper.
And it was actually at the jump event that I had participated in. Actually, it was back in, I think, 2008 or 2009 that I was at a jump event, when I kind of had this realization that there's a difference in mentorship, that there's an importance for us all to connect. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to meet colleagues, other fellows across the country that I had never met before, and just had this epiphany of, oh my gosh, we all have to connect. And it was actually at JUMP that the seed idea of WINC was planted, along with my colleague Aaron Powell, who is in Nova Scotia, or sorry, in Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
Oh my God.
She doesn't know her geography very well.
No, I don't know geography. I have other talents.
That's okay. You've got other talents. Yeah.
I won't quit my day job. But yeah, so she was there and we were talking about it. And the more I talked about it, the more there was people not realizing that this kind of thing didn't exist already. And then in recognition of the great support that I had received at JUMP, I then said, hey, I'm happy to come back as a mentor. And in the program, worked as a mentor. So kind of being on that inside and seeing it over the years, there was definitely a shift from, okay, let's focus on making sure that people have mentorship connections, which is so important, to adding other aspects to it. Hey, did you know that you need to include this stuff in your CV? Did you know that this is the kind of questions that you might get asked at an interview? Or did you know that you actually have some power to negotiate? And it's not just that you have to take the first job that is offered to you. And these are things that sound very simple, and but to medical professionals at the time were rather, you know,
you're asking people to step out of a very carefully constructed shell that they've built over decades. That is the story they were told about what it takes to survive. And then very quickly, they've got to step out of that.
They have to leap out of it. They have to jump out of it, one would say.
I was going to use that word too, but I think when you ask about how it has evolved, what we've seen, obviously what Simmons has mentioned, but also the big piece to me is the connections.
Yeah.
And the fact that people meet for the first time, spend a full day and a half, day and an evening together, immersed in, as you said, jumping out of kind of their, I would say, personal box and allowing them to really connect and really understand that they're not alone, that they are meeting other individuals that are also kind of suffering, but also recognizing the challenges that they are enduring and experiencing in their first 1 to 5 years of clinical practice. So I think that's where I find that it's incredible to see the aha moments in these individuals, because that I think to me has been the best part of it is the fact that they make these connections, and these connections last.
It's pretty incredible.
So I think
really
that's where we're building, building the connections across Canada, right?
Yeah.
All the medical oncologists. And that's really, to me, is the highlight.
And I think that as time has gone on as well, the connections, so very valuable, the space, the recognition that cancer care is complex, is becoming more complex and being comfortable with that complexity, being comfortable with that discomfort, and then digging a little deeper. And making some connections with regards to the importance of psychological safety in the workplace.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think we've come full circle, right?
And so then we have to acknowledge that Christina Crow has been an amazing and
addition to JUMP.
And the value that has been gained, and the mentees that come back afterwards and have said to me, oh my God, that was so amazing. I got so much more out of that than I thought I going to.
It's
more than just the connections. It's the connecting with self as well.
We don't want this workshop to be really about just didactic. Oh, this is how you build your CV. This is what you do. I mean, as we partner off with mentor mentees and we all meet each other, we have like this speed dating throughout the course of the day. But obviously, Christina Crow, your part in this is so important because it does allow us to recognize how we need to grow, right? How we need to develop and hone in our skills, and how it's okay to fail, to succeed, to make a mistake, to figure it out. So I think, we're human, right? So it's important for us to take that human side and jump with it.
As research-based people, I would say you're walking the talk there, because the psychological safety research started in medicine. And it started in high-performing healthcare teams, looking at what makes these teams the best. And the teams that were the best made more mistakes than the teams that weren't the best. But what made them the best is they were able to notice them, talk about them, iterate, problem solve, and move on and come up with better solutions faster than the other teams because it was okay to talk about it. And yeah, that's what spurred all the research from there, right?
It's like that statement, right? We're all perfectly fine. And
I think that's a book.
That brings
right?
up another great Canadian clinician and researcher that's also been a fantastic
addition to Jump.
Yeah.
Dr. Jillian Horton.
I will add the link to her book too for any docs that are listening that want to pick that up. It's a good one. Yeah.
Such a good read, because I think for so long, and as in her book, she kind of outlines this, even in our current training programs, there is this, I don't know, perfectionism in many ways that's beaten into you, or this that's beaten out of you, this expectation that you must do and not be in the moment. There's a lot of shift in residency training towards ensuring that there is wellness and that burnout issues are addressed.
Yeah.
But I think our residency training programs are still lagging very far behind. And I love my internal medicine colleagues, but it is a tough slog coming through internal medicine still, really in the era of the pandemic and in this post-pandemic world where we're still dealing with so many respiratory viruses and the fear that the public has of that as well, that leads them to come into medicine, into the hospital with much more dire medical situations.
Yeah, like they're delaying coming to hospital and going to doctors, which is delaying diagnosis, which is making your jobs even harder, right?
Yeah. And so those residents that are coming through, they've been taught, I have to do, I have to be there in the tough moments. There's that satisfaction of,
I have to be perfect.
Super doc.
I have to be perfect.
All things,
And now you can't sustain that for the next 40 years of your career. No one can. And it's important for us to really walk that back and really look at where that's coming from and challenge it.
I was going to say, like, what's the hardest part of being a mentor? But then I started thinking, so you can answer that, or it also could be like, if there's one thing you could like secretly whisper to incoming oncologists, like, here's the thing you need to know, the real deal, what would it be? I don't know if those are two totally different things
or not. Yeah, I think the first question, what is one of the hardest things about being a mentor? It isn't easy to be a mentor, right? Mm-hmm. Being a good mentor means that you are there for the other person. So you're coming to that meeting without your own agenda. It's not about turning someone into a mini-me. It's not about my research. It's not about what I can offer you in terms of connections. It's me being there for that mentee, listening, recognizing that sometimes it's not about the nail, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just need me to listen, and helping them to identify what the potential solutions are, right? And realizing that as a mentor, I'm actually not supposed to have all the answers for them. And I think that's also the challenge for us in medicine as medical professionals, is to realize that it's not that we're supposed to actually have all of the answers. I use an acronym when I'm in a good mentorship, when I'm mentoring someone, and that is GROW. What is the goals of this person in front of me? What's their current reality, right? Mm. Does that measure up with their goals? What are those obstacles to the goal that they might have? And what is their will? What is their true desire to achieve that goal? Mm. Is that goal there because it's a goal that someone else put there for them?
That's huge to assess that.
There for themselves.
Yeah, it's I like your GROW.
That is good. I like that
algorithm there, Simmons. I'm always learning from you. Mm. I think the big piece for me, it is, I mean, we say mentorship, a big part of it's sponsorship, right? We are here to really sponsor that individual. And it's not, you're absolutely right, Simmons, it's not about you, it's about them, and really making, again, the connections, right? It's that many times they'll come and say, oh, I have this idea, how do I go about doing it? Or I can't meet with so-and-so, the door is closed. And so obviously facilitating their growth and sponsoring them. And I'm probably not being as eloquent as Simmons, but we're there to listen, we're there to provide them that support. And as we are, as I said, leaders in different ways, leadership, a big part of leadership is always sponsoring your team, always listening to your team, and having them also come with solutions, right? Yeah. They'll get there. They'll figure that out.
Yeah.
But guiding them to make sure they hit their goal and that they're able to achieve their goal.
Totally. Totally.
I think that's amazing. And, you know, that part about sponsorship can't be, I think that applies in probably all, well, a lot of professions, but most certainly across the board in medicine. But that also really applies in my field as well, and in psychotherapy, when, you know, even as we train novice therapists, we train practicum interns. And then when you've got these like really incredibly talented therapists, they're just good. Like they just get it. And they've got big ideas and they're going to go so far. And I'll say to people, like, you're going to be my boss one day. Like I don't want to do anything to hold you back. I want to do everything to sponsor you and help lift you up onto my shoulders so that I can be proud to say I'm tagged onto you, or I helped with your growth, or I protected you somewhere along the way so that you could launch. I mean, I think that's really mm-hmm. an incredible thing. And the fact that you guys intentionally embark in your spare time to provide this for your colleagues is probably one of the greatest things you can do to buffer burnout and to make sure people know totally. That there's yeah. a place where it cares.
Yeah. But you yeah. know, it actually, it helps us too, right? Like it's,
yeah. oh yeah. There's a bit of a selfishness there, right?
You know, when I think about when I was developing Wink, to be honest with you, I wasn't in a very good place. Mm-hmm. I was in a very challenging place. And it was one of those things that, yeah, creating a not-for-profit organization in Canada takes some work, takes a lot of work, apparently. But as it was so therapeutic, I think, in many yeah. ways to do it, I was getting so much out of it. It actually pulled me up. I was feeling better from seeing how others were being pulled up by it as well. It was yeah. providing me with that purpose, right?
Meaningful.
With that North
yeah.
Star on that, yeah. on that polarity map. And so much so that when I looked back, I still to this day, am not entirely sure when or how I did it, but
it was like, your kids, how you did it.
Yeah.
You
know?
Okay.
But it sounds like you weren't doing it by yourself, right? And so when we join hands with other people who get it, who we have a shared outlook on the world, shared values, shared kind of goals, then kind of anything is possible. It's very true.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. Every time I spoke about it, I got nothing other than people egging me on. And so yeah. I was like, all right, I'm going to keep talking about this and keep moving forward until I reach a brick wall somewhere. And if the brick wall is coming, then I guess it's going to just be a thing now.
Trainees know where to find you guys, right? Like, I don't need to.
I hope so. People. Yeah. I mean,
we're Googleable.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the residency training program at UBC, mm-hmm. we have a site that has my contact info on it as well.
Okay.
I'm always happy to connect with trainees anywhere.
Okay. Two takeaways or a takeaway each from you about what you think the most important things are that you'd like people to remember leaving our conversation here?
Oh, summing everything up into one sentence is so hard sometimes, right?
You can use more than one. It's okay.
Be kind, be brave, and learn to jump.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I was going to say, you're not alone. Everyone has a story to share. Just open your heart and listen. Yeah.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I love hanging out and talking to you. It's wonderful. Likewise. I will connect to, there's a couple of things there that were mentioned throughout that I'll connect to. And for people that are interested, there is actually specific Canadian research that's done talking about like burnout amongst oncology professionals
yeah.
in Canada. There was a specific paper you mentioned at the beginning that referenced the difference between how women are mentored versus your male colleagues.
I can send you some of those resources as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of literature on that and research. And there's also disparities and financial disparities. That's really, Nancy Baxter
huge.
Led all of that work.
Okay.
Surgeons, for example. So it's everywhere. It touches all aspects of healthcare, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many other things that we didn't get to, but are still relevant. So one thing sometimes we talk about too, is even like medical marriages or oncology marriages are different from other fields and other professions, and having partners and family members who understand what it means that their mom or their wife or their dad or their husband is not just a doctor, but an oncologist, rad-onc, med-onc, heme, whatever your specialty is, that life is going to be a bit different. It's hard to talk about with people outside of the profession. It's the same thing for therapy, like therapy marriages or lawyer marriages or academic families. Like, the pressures are different. And so being able to have spaces where people can come together, and it's not just commiserating, it's finding a place of understanding. And
that's where that's where this oncotourism comes in.
I think what you're saying there too, the oncological marriages are different, except Preston and I both married engineers. Kids that are very much the same in age. And I think what you're saying there, Christina, kind of speaks to the importance of ensuring that your family has that support too, right? So yes, Preston and I are friends. And yes, we have gone on vacation together, not to do with oncology at all. Our families get a lot out of that as well, right? Yeah. And you know, having our husbands be able to look at each other and say, oh yeah, here they go again. They're off on some tangent to save the world in eye rolls.
Right. being able to take it in stride.
Very supportive husbands, but yeah. having the support for you.
Yeah, supportive partners, to be honest. I think that makes a world of difference. Provides, again, that you talk about psychological safety, right? At home, in your personal life.
Yeah.
That you're able to achieve that, because my kids look at me and they're like, I'm never going into medicine.
Yeah.
Like, you work too hard.
That's what
I look back, I go, I do. Like, because when you're in it, you don't maybe realize that you're busy and working.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing COVID did is it gave us a pause, right? Gave us a pause to reevaluate your home life and your relationships, get a dog, both of us.
Did you guys both get dogs during COVID?
I did. Yes. Mine's behind me right now.
Oh,
yes. Mine's being coiffed right now. He's going to look gorgeous.
The spa.
Book guy. He is. No, but this is all part of it, right? This is all part of how we deal with our own stresses. People work out. Unfortunately, some people are involved in risky behavior or bad habits. Alcohol has increased dramatically. Mm-hmm. Other, obviously, illicit drugs probably have as well. I don't know. I'm not into that stuff. But that's what I worry about, right? Is if you don't have that area of, or that opportunity, ability to vent in other ways, then it can go sour pretty quickly.
I think there's that ability of an organization to also kind of step in there too, right? So the chair of the Tumor Group Council, and one of the things that I've incorporated, actually that I borrowed from my husband, and again, you learn from everywhere. I realized that, he works for Transport Canada, and they're doing these health checks or check-ins or report cards each They do a round table and talk about how they're doing from different aspects. And one of the aspects that they each rank is wellness. And I was like, we should be doing that. So at the meetings that I chair now, at some point, and it's people felt a little bit awkward. So we have embraced Zoom and have it as a Zoom poll. Okay. Tell us how your group is doing, how your team is doing, education perspective, research perspective, how the processes and systems are doing, and how is your team's wellness?
Yeah. How's everyone feeling?
Wellness is like a big umbrella word, right? Like, no offense to you, Simmons, but I'm so tired of that word.
You start having the space for it in the meeting,
I think you have to.
And initially it was like, oh my God, I don't know what the wellness is. I haven't asked the rest of my team. Why not?
I think that's a great point though, right?
I like Christina. You made saying, it your how own. Are you guys feeling? Like, how are you feeling? Did you take your vacation? Are you doing anything interesting? Are you going to see a play? Are you like, honestly, to me, it's more of that culture, right? And I have such a big beef about this because we have a committee on wellness and to decrease burnout. And I'm like, but the culture that you're making people work in is a burnout culture.
Yeah.
So I don't care if you have someone come to talk to us about wellness
and
show us data on burnout.
Yeah.
What are we actually doing? Oh, we're going to have an event. We're going to have a Zoom event. at six to 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night.
Right.
To talk. And I'm like, that's your wellness?
It's not a question that's just kind of a throwaway or, I need you to go out and ask everyone about their wellness. It is changing.
It's the olive culture. Branch.
Culture when the leader of the tumor group council, I'm saying it is important for us to be addressing this as leaders. It's important for us to be getting a sense of this. And even if it is to say, you know what, and I just have people graded as red, yellow, green. And then we put up a map, right? And say, okay, this is where everything's at. And sometimes even just looking at that and realizing, wow, everyone's in a pretty crummy place right now. And what do we do about that? Is that a problem to be solved or is that a dilemma? At least we're providing that space. There is data, there is a paper that has been published. And yes, you are right, it's a little bit more female than male. But just as we have the fight and flight response to stress, there is also the tend and befriend response. And that's a different hormonal, it's not your epinephrine, it's not your adrenaline that gets released. It's a different hormone. I can't remember what it's called.
It's oxytocin, right?
Probably. Yeah. Probably.
Serotonin, oxytocin.
It tends to be more common.
It's one of these other neurostimulants.
Yeah.
It's something that does get released when you're in a stress response and that need to tend, that need to go and look after your group, and that need to talk, that need to befriend and to connect.
Human.
It's exactly the connection. And but I like what you said, Samantha. It is a touch point. It's important to have.
I know you did. Even when you disagree with me, you agree with me.
It's the touch points. It's to have that space to acknowledge, like you said, Crow, like, how are you feeling? Like, is everything okay?
Yeah.
Can I do anything to help? Like, but it's, again, the culture of caring. So you have to have an environment where that is true to its word.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be touting you data on wellness because what does that mean, right?
Yep.
If you're not working in an environment where you can't take a week off or 2 weeks off because no one's there to cover for you, or you're told you can't take that off, or you're told that this is the deadline, you have to have this done by yesterday, or you're told, now I'm going to put you on two more committees where your responsibilities are X, X, Y, Y. Now, of course you're going to burn out. But yet I'm at the same breath saying we can't let you burn out. So really it's the culture that has to be developed. And I think that's where we as institutions are truly failing. And we have to recognize that we are failing and then make changes. So one positive change: no meetings before 8 o'clock, although they're still occurring. No meetings after 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a young mom or you're a mom that has to deal with childcare, you're excluded. You can't, or you have that guilt that I can't go to that meeting because I have to also,
my priorities are all over the place. Yep.
So these are examples now that are trying to be implemented and work. Weekend emails, right? We don't want to be sending emails on a Saturday night or a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And you'll see some people say, please don't feel obliged to reply to this.
I've got that.
Reply to when you have time, right? Even though I've sent it to you on a Sunday, don't reply today.
Yeah.
But I have sent it to you on a Sunday, which means I'm probably expecting you to reply on a Sunday, right? Like, to be honest, if it can wait till Monday morning,
You can schedule send them or let them sit in your
draft folder. These are examples that we're trying to make some changes, and they are being implemented. For example, University of Toronto, they're being implemented specifically for those reasons, right? That you should not be obliged. You need to have your time is valued, and you are valued. And that, I think, will lessen a little bit of that burnout when that individual feels valued. But if you're working in a culture that does not value you, it doesn't matter how much.
Values all of you. They don't value just the doctor part that you show up to contribute.
No.
They value you and your role as a mother, your role in the community, your role as a friend, your role as a contributor to the community of the hospital or the organization as well, right? All parts of you. So you when you're at your best and you when you need support. Yeah. Right? The whole thing.
Having those meetings, whatever time they're occurring at, but being there because you're the bum in the chair, as opposed to being there because your opinion is really valued and
people want to hear it.
Yeah.
The nice thing that I've seen with the leadership that the two of you offer, the people that are lucky enough that get to be in your orbit, I think is you walk the talk. And so you're not just saying, here's what we know about psychological safety because of these studies and this is what we should do. Like, you guys are actually doing it, and you've been doing it for decades. You're not just doing it now. Like, it's a great idea, right? So it's nice to see like proof is in the pudding. And it's really neat for me coming in, because I'm a stranger when I come into the mentees. The mentors kind of know me now, I think. And I literally watch their defenses like fade right in front of me as in real time, as I'm going through some of the content, starting from the night before to the morning even. And the places where it seems clear to me where they're allowing their other parts to come forward, not just their doctor parts.
Yeah.
To connect with their colleagues, to show up. And I think sometimes we have to, I go in like through the lens of what they know to be true, which is, I know you care about your patients. This affects how you show up to deliver great care, because the ultimate downside of doctor burnout is an increase in patient error, right? And so if ultimately what we all care about are patients, no matter what stakeholder you are in the game, that we have to care about doctors. We have to care about how this culture applies stress in a good way. When people feel psychologically safe, that's when they can join together in that connection and grow and become even smarter and learn and more engaged and do powerful things, right? It's when there's no safety and there's too much stress that's super toxic. And when there's no stress and lots of safety, we get bored and we get complacent and that's no fun either. So finding a culture that has the right balance of both is such an art form, but it has to be done by the leadership.
And that how you do a hard job well.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's leaders that have to come up with the solutions, right? Like, nothing drove me crazier when I was in industry and people leadership would look down on their direct reports and say, come with solutions if you don't like this. And it's like, I got to punch above my pay grade too. Like, I got to solve the problem too. Come on, guys. Yeah. It is leadership that needs to put their heads together to come up with solutions to get the best out of their people, right? And I think the program that you guys have put together most certainly does that. It's really neat watching you do that.
Thank you. We enjoy doing it.
And it is so awesome chatting with you, Christina. And I think I speak for both of us. We'd love to come back anytime and do more podcasts with you. Unfortunately, I do have another meeting apparently.
I know, you've got to go. I've kept you over your time. Anyway.
I do want to.
Thanks, guys.
Pleasure as always. Connect.
Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Christina Crow Podcast. I hope you found today's discussion informative and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this episode today, please consider subscribing, leave a review, or share it with someone who might benefit from this discussion. Your support helps me continue the mission to make invisible things visible and accessible. Until next time, take care of your mind, and remember that seeking help and understanding is absolutely a sign of strength. If you or someone you know is in need of support, please seek out professional advice through the links in the show notes or on the website. Thank you for being a part of this community, and remember, you're not alone on this journey.